This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Identity. It's been a large topic for years and has gained momentum as everyone is flying their representative flag, and I love it. I have been on the journey of identity for as long as I can remember. He, she, they, androgynous, which can now be identified as gender fluid, bisexual, which to some reflects pan, others, there's a difference. But what else am I? Writer? Sometimes. Daughter and sister always. That person that will be your personal cheer squad. A crystal healer, Reiki master, soul sister, cat lover, lifelong learner, Aussie. Join me as I explore how others identify and listen as they discover their own identity crisis. Meet Rain. Rain is a member of my community and I'm fascinated to hear how Rain identifies. Welcome, Rain. First of all, I want to ask, what are your pronouns and how do you identify on the rainbow?
Oh, thanks for having me, Izzy. My pronouns are they, them, and on the rainbow, I plug into a few little dots. So I sort of start with non-binary and asexual when I'm telling people where I sort of fit in. And then sort of nestled under that, I sort of say that I'm also pan-romantic, which confuses people a little bit because I say I'm asexual, but yeah.
How is your identity received in the community?
Depends on the groups and the people you talk to, really. You find a lot of people, well, not a lot, but a vocal minority, which feels like a lot of people in a small community, actually aren't very accepting when, you know, you're not, I guess, sexually active in the community. There seems to be a small group that sort of go, well, if you're asexual, you're not actually queer. But then you've also got other people that are very, very welcoming. And it's sort of, I'm not going to say it balances itself out, but it's sort of, it's nice having that welcoming element because particularly from like the asexual sort of standpoint, like you're not experiencing traditional life that a cishet normative person would experience. Like your experiences are still queer experiences, so it's nice to sort of be able to have some community, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Vocal minority, I really like that phrase. Why do you think the vocal minority are not as accepting of your identity?
I honestly think it's just tied down to the whole carryover of a traditional relationship. So like whether you're like gay, bi, cis, whatever, you know, you meet someone, generally you fall in love or have some kind of romantic or sexual attraction with them. And then ultimately you end up in a sexual relationship with them. Right. And I'm gonna say a lot, but not all asexual people sort of don't necessarily fit into that last category. And so then somehow the vocal minority sort of feel that that means that you aren't experiencing the true queer experience. And it doesn't matter whether or not it's an asexual person that's never had sex with anyone or it's an asexual person that before they figured out that they're asexual, they were actually sexually active in the queer community. It just seems to be this weird mentality. I don't know. It's almost, yeah, I don't know. It's, yeah.
It's like you're not having a proper relationship according to the community because you're not having sex. Is that how it feels?
Yeah. Which is ridiculous because, you know, there are asexual people out there that do have sex. Like, it's being ace doesn't mean that you can't have sex. It's just that for whatever reason, and, you know, it's every individual ace person's personal feelings and choices on the matter. Like, you don't necessarily feel the need to go down that path, and somehow people seem to think that invalidates your experiences.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And you touched on being pan-romantic earlier. How does that impact your identity in the community?
I think if, you know, I wasn't also using the asexual bit, I don't think it would confuse people at all. I think we've got a growing understanding of what it means to experience some kind of attraction to multiple genders in our community now. Like, we've had the bi pause for many years in the community. Mm. And now, you know, we've sort of expanded the terminology in use, and we've got, you know, pan-romantic and pansexual, or just plain old pan for people that identify as both, that bit doesn't really confuse people until they go, hang on, but didn't you say you're asexual? And it sort of confuses them because, well, a lot of people don't think of asexual people as being able to have romantic feelings, I think. For me, it's not something I experience often, but I do actually experience romantic attraction. And for me, gender has no place in that, you know, romantic attraction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think anyone can understand that sometimes you are romantically attracted to people and may not be sexually attracted to them, and vice versa. You might be sexually attracted to them but really don't want to date them. And you also identify as non-binary. How does that affect how you identify in not just the gay community, but in the community as a whole in regional Victoria?
Certainly in the Ballarat community, I feel like there's not a very good understanding yet of gender diversity, and I think that affects more than just being non-binary. I feel like there's still not a great understanding of being trans in Ballarat, or, you know, gender fluid, genderqueer, any of those sorts of things. I think there still needs to be a lot of education. So people get quite confused, I think, by anything that's not, you know, the normal binary of male and female. For work, so for instance, I wear the male uniform at work, and so people just assume, you know, male, and gender doesn't really come up. When it's like that, that doesn't really confuse people, but it's when you start to actually have an interpersonal dialogue and you sort of introduce the idea of, well, if actually my pronouns are they, them, then it sort of starts to get into that area where people get really confused and frustrated.
They get frustrated?
Yeah, I have encountered frustrated. And then there's been a few times where I've actually found people like trying to interrogate me to try and get, I don't know whether it's to try and get their head around the whole non-binary and the use of the they, them pronouns, or whether they think they're going to trip me up, because, you know, you encounter that online too. People sort of think, aha, I'm going to trip this person up and prove that they're just faking.
Yeah, right. And because they are asking questions, do you see part of your role in the community, part of your identity, is educating people on what non-binary, asexuality, panromantic, those kind of things are?
I think anyone on the queer spectrum probably in part would have to say that they're partly an educator as part of their identity, just because it doesn't matter where you are, you're always going to run the chance of encountering someone who's unaware. And some of the people that are unaware are actually really great. Like, once you explain it to them, they're very accepting and they're like, oh, I'd never thought of it that way. And like, they actually make a real effort. And I think that's really cool when you run into those sorts of people.
Is it ever tiring and you just think, why is this my role?
Yes, all the time. It's 2021. I just don't understand why it's such a big deal that the queer community as a whole exists, let alone, you know, all our different facets. I think that the queer community is incredibly valuable and can be a really great support network. But I also sort of feel that we've existed for a long time, so in some ways it should just be that we're part of society and people shouldn't be confused and upset by it.
You mention you wear, and I'm putting this in inverted commas, the male uniform at work. How do you identify at work?
I almost view going to work as like a 9-hour role play session. Because of where we live and the sorts of people I work with and the sorts of people I deal with through work, I let it slide, the whole assumed male thing, and I don't make it a big deal because it gets tiring, like really, really exhausting just every day if you have to sort of fight for every little inch. Yeah. So there's some areas that I probably shouldn't, but I let it slide.
Yeah. And we're so close to Melbourne, and yet it's still going on in this town. It's frustrating.
Yeah, it's incredibly frustrating because, at least for me anyway, I find that it's not just like at work that you're constantly having to sort of, if you try and make that stand and that distinction, that it's an everyday battle. Like, for me, you have that battle with family and you have that battle with society in general. And it's just like, it works its way into every aspect of your life. And that's why I say it's exhausting, and sometimes you let stuff slide that maybe you shouldn't, but you just don't have the spoons for it, especially at the moment, like we're in a global pandemic, and that's just exhausting on itself.
Absolutely. So you mentioned family. How does it work with them? Are they aware of your identity?
most of my family is aware that I'm queer. I don't think there's anyone in the family that's not aware that I fall into, like... And my apologies for the use of the word queer if anyone finds that word offensive. Personally, it's a title I actually use a lot, so... But accepting a lot of my family's not. So after my initial coming out many, many years ago now, I sort of was at odds with a lot of my family, and I'm now estranged from, like, 99% of my family. So for, like, 99% of my family, they sort of aren't aware where I am now in my life as far as who I am and how I identify. So it took me a long time to find my way to accepting that I was non-binary and that I was asexual. Yeah, for a lot of my family, they don't know because I haven't spoken to them in, you know, some of them nearly 20 years.
So would you identify as brother or son or nephew or any of those other familial terms?
Cousin. I like the word cousin. That's fine. I tend to go with sibling when, like, talking about the fact that I have siblings. I actually like the word spawn too, so I quite often... If, like, in relation to my mother, who I do still have a relationship with, I just sort of, like, I'm such and such a spawn, and that gets a few looks, but they're like, okay.
That gives me giggles. That gives me big giggles. That is hilarious. So you do have a relationship with your mother, but you don't call yourself son. It's spawn.
Yeah, I like spawn, or, you know, if people get really confused, it's like, I'm such and such as kid, and they're like, oh, okay, cool.
Kid, yes, perfect.
Yeah, well, you know, it's, kid is not, you know, traditionally any gender. It applies to both, so everybody's different. Everyone has the pronouns that are theirs, and everyone, you know, has the words that then come from that, so, you know, it is going to be different for every individual person on the rainbow, but... I don't think it's that hard to wrap your head around. I'm not going to name names, but, like, my nephew has started their transition. And, you know, it took the family a little bit to get used to using their name and their pronouns. But we did it. It wasn't hard. You know, it was just making sure to double check yourself every time you spoke in the initial beginning that you didn't dead name or dead gender them. It's really easy. And, you know, you see a lot of information on the internet, like, where people are like, when you don't know someone's identity, it's very easy to use gender neutral pronouns. Like, how is that hard once you know someone's name? Once you know that someone identifies as non-binary, like, it's not hard.
Welcome back to Identity Crisis, where we're discovering how Rain identifies. Now, I know that you're a little bit on the witchy spectrum. How do you identify on the witchy spectrum?
It depends what year you ask me. It's a tumultuous journey I've found with the witchy community. Like, you sort of, you think you've found where you are, and then, no, maybe this is not where I am, and you keep sort of, I guess it's like the queer experience. Some people find exactly where they belong straight away and stay there, and other members of us keep shifting around the rainbow. And yeah, for me, with the witchy community, it's sort of been the same. You sort of, sometimes you'll settle on something for a little while, and after you've sort of sat on it for a while and thought about it, you're like, maybe this is not quite where I am. Once you're sure that it's not for you, then you sort of, not that I believe in closing yourself off from experiences, but you open yourself up to the possibility of maybe I'm wrong, and therefore I need to be open to all the experiences and try and figure out where I do belong. I've gone back to grassroots, really, like to the beginning, and I'm like, I'm going to assume everything I know is wrong and start again at the start, and maybe this time I'll end up in the right spot.
That's very brave.
I kind of feel sometimes if you're in the wrong spot, it's actually less healthy and more damaging to stay there once you realise that maybe it's not right. Yeah, okay, it might be a bit brave, but I think in the long run, it's for the better.
Mm. And how is your witchy identity received within the community?
Honestly, I think that's less of a problem for a lot of people than being somewhere on the rainbow. I don't encounter a lot of problems with people are just like, oh, you know, you're a bit new agey or you're a bit spiritually or whatever, that's cool. And that's generally the extent of a lot of the conversation. It's only sort of once you start to get further into the witchy community and, you know, people are wanting to know where you fit. And I think a lot of the time with the witchy community, they're trying to figure out where you fit so that they understand how you relate to their experiences, which, you know, I guess that sort of translates to all of life. Like, if you understand other people, like some of the experiences other people have, you can understand what shared experiences you may have had and understand them a bit deeper.
A sense of belonging and a sense of same.
Yeah, very much so. And at the end of the day, I think everyone wants to belong somewhere.
Yeah, for sure. And I know we've been attempting to play D&D together online and I just keep failing at it terribly. So you have another identity. Can you tell me more about your D&D identity?
I guess, yeah, like my D&D identity is kind of like a sub-identity of, if I was describing myself, I would say that I'm a gamer and I do like gamer as a G-A-Y-M-E-R just because it really upsets the dude bros and the incels of the internet. It's something that I really enjoy. It is a hobby, like, but it gives you a chance to connect with other people in ways that you might not necessarily do otherwise in real life. And I kind of, it's fun, and you get to create these characters and look at life from different perspectives. So if you've been playing D&D for a little while, or even if you're new to it, quite often the character you're playing is nothing at all like who you are in real life. Because as much as, you know, your personal life is quite good, it's interesting to explore these other facets. This campaign, maybe I'm going to explore what it's like to be an evil bastard and pretend I'm a member of the Liberal Party. Like, and just, I don't know, I feel like it broadens your horizons, which is always a good thing.
You mentioned that you are, and I love the spelling, a gamer. Is that an identity that you have as well? And is there a gaming community?
There is actually a gamer community. There's a lot of gamer communities, but it's a really, most of the time, it's a really great place to be. Like, I belong to a few Facebook groups and stuff, and my experiences with them have been quite positive. They're usually, it doesn't matter, you know, whether you're lesbian, bi, whatever, in those communities, what people are more interested in is the games that they're enjoying and the stories. And, like, the shared experiences. And so people will quite often go into these groups and they'll be like, hey, I've just found this game. It's by a small indie company. It has the possibility of playing as a gay or a lesbian character. I just thought people might want to know. I really enjoyed the storyline and the romance options were really good. You know, not all games have romance, obviously. And so it's really nice sort of having people coming along going, this is what I liked about this game, this is how it's queer, what aspects of it are queer positive, and I thought that was really cool sort of thing. And you can then evaluate for yourself whether or not it's something that you want to invest time and money into exploring as well.
That's amazing. So there are queer positive games out there.
Yeah, there are. It's becoming a little bit more common. Like, I'm not going to say it's mainstream. Just because it's 2021 doesn't mean that, you know, like, it's not always going to be queer positive, but certainly compared to when I first started in the game community, there are more options available now, like, to sort of have characters around you or to play as a character that does experience some kind of rainbow lifestyle experience, which is nice. And I think it's really important too. Like, you would have had a similar thing, like, when you're growing up, looking for role models and people that are like you. And I know for me, like, when I was growing up, they just didn't exist. I had to hunt really, really hard for just, you know, a fraction of representation. So I think for up-and-coming generations, having mainstream computer games and stuff that allow you the possibility of some kind of queer experience is really important, because there's a chance that that's the first time they've seen a fictional character and gone, hey, they're a bit like me, and felt accepted, you know?
Representation.
Yeah.
And so you feel that would help to shape an identity faster than what it normally would, or do you think it would absolutely change an identity?
Oh, I don't feel qualified to say whether it'd do either of those things. I feel like maybe it would help some people anyway to have a little bit more of acceptance of themselves and understand that maybe who they are is okay, and just because they're not like their parents or, you know, their brother or sister or whoever doesn't mean that they're not valid either.
You're listening to Identity Crisis, and we're speaking with Rain. If there was an asexual, non-binary, pan-romantic role model that happened to be around when you were growing up, do you think it would have been easier for you to identify as who you are?
Possibly. Honestly, growing up, for me anyway, I grew up in a small country town. I lived on a cattle farm. And I grew up in an extremely homophobic family. So for me, just having access to any kind of queer representation would have been super helpful. I honestly didn't even sort of start to come across things like non-binary and asexual until, I don't know, 7 years ago. And I was like, hey, that's real cool. You know, there's more to the rainbow than meets the eye sort of thing. And then you sort of, the more you sort of learn about some stuff, the more you go, oh my god, that explains so much.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, then you start to do your research, which, again, so much easier now. Like, we didn't have the internet at home until I went to university. We didn't have proper internet. We had internet for a little bit when I was in high school for my dad's business, but, like, it was a, you know, shared computer sort of situation and dial-up, and, you know, the information that was out there was not very good.
Do you identify as country?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I do. Like, the majority of my life I've lived rurally. I've had a few goes at living sort of more metropolitan and bigger cities, but it doesn't play well with my social anxiety. I sort of like having a little bit of space and being not quite surrounded by so many people. So yeah, I guess from that point of view, like, yeah, I guess I would identify as country, but that doesn't mean that I 100% approve of all of the small town bigotry and attitudes that sometimes goes with it.
And what about politics? How do you identify?
I don't know. That's sort of always changing, because I don't really like affiliating myself with any one political party, because, you know, as politicians change and the political party's values change, they're no longer necessarily align with your own. So for me, I am all about, you know, kindness and compassion. So that's what I look for is, you know, are we treating each other as fellow human beings, like human beings, or are we treating them like an asset to exploit?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely helpful. Because what it shows is that you don't identify with a particular party, and the reason being is they don't represent you.
Yeah, of the sort of bigger parties for us here in Australia, if I was going to sort of say one, it would be the Greens would probably come the closest, but I don't agree with everything that they say either. This is going to be the way, like, for me personally, I can't imagine a world where I find a political party where I'm like, you are 100% spot on. Like, I get that happens for a lot of people, that, like, they'll see, say, Pauline Hanson and the One Nation Party and go, oh my god, and, like, standing ovation sort of thing. I understand that is actually a thing. I come from a family of people that think that's great, and I am really confused by it, given that I'm from a migrant family, but, you know.
So you're from a migrant family. Where does your family come from?
On my mother's side of the family, they migrated to Australia in the 60s, I want to say. And so, yeah, like, my mother's family, yeah, they come from Italy, started with nothing and worked their way into society, you know. They had some interesting attitudes when they came here. Like, once they got here, my grandparents were very strict on, we only speak English in the house, you know, so. And that was, they were trying to integrate as fast as possible into Australian society, so they felt like, you know, enforcing only speaking English at home. But it also meant that the language acquisition happened a bit quicker for them too, or at least that's what they say. And it's kind of interesting, because my grandparents outside have long since passed away, but their children that are still alive and well have some really weird, like, they are quite proud to be Australian, which, nothing wrong with that, but they sort of concern me a little bit, like when you do see them and they do talk about stuff and you're like, wow, you are so racist. What happened? Like, you weren't even from Australia and you're saying, oh, all these foreigners, you know, need to go back where they come from. It's like, hang on. Right. What?
So do you identify as Australian, Italian Australian? How do you identify?
I identify as Australian because of the way my mum and her siblings were raised. Like, for us, Italian culture wasn't a big part of our lives, which, I don't know, I feel like that's a little bit sad. Yeah. I feel it's a little bit sad that they came to a new country and they felt like they couldn't bring anything with them. But that's okay. They've all had successful lives. So, like, my mum and her siblings are all, you know, 60 plus now, or the ones that are alive anyway. They've all had successful lives and really great careers in Australia. So, you know, they're grateful to, you know, have had those opportunities, and I'm happy for them that they had them, but...
Are you ever curious about where you come from? Is there anything that sparks some identity from there within you?
I am a little bit curious, yeah. And once COVID's over, we have talked about, I say we, my housemate and I, who are best friends, we have actually talked about doing a trip to Italy and visiting the village that my mum's family came from when we're there, which I don't know whether that'll... I don't know that it'll actually provide any kind of experience at all, but... it'll satiate some curiosity, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm glad you brought up your best mate. I know you have been best mates and housemates for quite some time. Identifying as a best mate, what is that like for you?
It doesn't mean that you're necessarily the bestest friend in the world, but it's sort of, it gives you a little bit of a feeling of belonging, I guess. And I quite like that, like saying that, you know, someone's my best friend and knowing that it's a reciprocated thing, you sort of like, well, you know, no matter what else happens, I do have people like that in my life that accept me for who I am and how I am, and I belong, and I do the same for them. And so I guess you could sort of tie it back into that community, like having a really strong interpersonal relationship with friends is part of your community.
Yeah, for sure. It's part of the identity. Who's your gang?
Yeah.
That's very cool. It's rare to have the kind of friendship that you and your best mate have.
It's been a really interesting ride for both of us, but I don't think we'd change anything. It can be a little bit interesting. Like, my housemate sometimes has some health issues, and when they're in hospital or whatever, people just assume that you're a spouse, and then they get really confused when you're like, no, we're just best friends. And they're like... but you're like each other's emergency contacts. And it's like, so? Like, what's wrong with that? Like, we live together, have done for a long time, and, like, family. Like, we're like, it's like living with a sibling that you really, you know, you actually like and don't fight with.
And finally, how do you want the world to identify you?
I guess if I was... wanted the world to identify me as something, I'd hope that it would be as someone who's compassionate and understanding, because I think they're both, like, compassion, kindness, understanding, I think they're something that we need more of in the world, so I'd like to think that that's something I'm bringing, and hopefully, you know, there's a lot of other people that are too.
Found most extraordinary about listening to Rain's journey as they put on the different hats of identity is sometimes there is no hat to wear. Sometimes it's because it doesn't exist, and sometimes it's because you can't. In my own identity crisis, I have always in my mind, in my heart, and in my soul been queer. But it's only been in the last 3 years that I have fully embraced what it is to be queer, what it is to be me, and work out where I fit on the rainbow. And that's encouraging, it's empowering, and it's terrifying. But it's been the best thing I've ever done for myself. I'm hoping Listening to the stories of others as they talk about their different identities, it will encourage others to look inside and see what they're hiding or what hats they're not wearing, what hats they are wearing and are not conscious of wearing, so they can find their full identity, whether it be on the rainbow, off the rainbow, or in the whole community. Today I've been Izzy. Sometimes I'm Belle, always Isabel. Until the next identity crisis.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.